Today is May 24th, 2019. This is Jessica Mack. I'm here interviewing Patricia Graham at the Guttman Library at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So could you state your name, first of all?
My name is Patricia Alvear Graham, and Alvear is my maiden name, which I use, as well as my husband's name, which I've been using for nearly 65 years. And my maiden name is spelled A-L-B as in boy, J-E-R-G.
Thank you. Wonderful. Yes. So why don't we start by, let me ask you to tell us, what was your affiliation with Princeton? What brought you to Princeton in the first place?
I came to Princeton in September of 1969 as a result of a conversation between the president of Princeton, Robert Goheen, and the president of Barnard College, where I was then an associate professor. The president was Martha Peterson. They were both on the board of the American Council on Education. And in the spring of 1969, at a board meeting, apparently President Goheen said to President Peterson, "We think we might go co-ed at Princeton this fall. We have no women on the faculty. Do you have any woman on your faculty or somebody on your faculty who could advise us on how to teach the girls?" And she said, she thought a few minutes, and then she suggested me. And I was then running the education program at Barnard and teaching in the history department. She also knew that my husband was going to be during the 69-70 year at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, and therefore I would probably be willing to do this, since it meant we could move to Princeton and put our daughter in the Princeton Public Schools in the eighth grade. So, then they realized, Goheen and Peterson, that the American Council of Education board on which they were sitting had a program that paid for administrative interns, and so I was put into that program. I arrived in September. I met with President Goheen, who was titularly supposed to supervise me, and it was pretty clear that that was not something that was likely to happen, and that he said, "Just tell us what you think should happen." Well, of course, I didn't have the faintest idea what should happen, and I didn't know Princeton at all. I'd never gone to Princeton, of course. My husband hadn't gone to Princeton. One boy in my small town in Indiana had gone to Princeton, my class, but I hadn't stayed in touch with him. So Princeton was new territory for me. So I had an office on the second floor of Nassau Hall, and I went to my office and waited to see what happened. Nothing happened. So I was working on a book. People kept saying, "What's that woman doing on the second floor?" It was a very nice man, Aaron Lemonet, who was dean of the graduate school. And he would stop by just to chat as a gracious gesture. And he said, "Well, now, why is it you're here?" And I said, "Well, I'm supposed to be involved in helping Princeton figure out what it should do to make itself as good a place for girls as it has traditionally been for boys." And he said, "Well, what do you think that is?" Well, I said, "I think the most serious thing is for there to be women on the faculty who are just as competent as the men on the faculty. But I said it wouldn't hurt if they had a little dash of feminism, because the girls need to see somebody who looks like them, who's in command in the university." Well, he said, "That sounds right." So we said, "You ought to be talking to the dean of the faculty." So pretty soon the dean of the faculty, Richard Lester, called me. And Richard Lester was a very nice man, a very kind man. He was an economist, which is some distance, academically speaking, from a historian in those days. Historians think one way. Economists have another mindset that they bring to the study of their problems. And we talked, and I said that, we had basically the same conversation, and he said, "Well, what do you think ought to happen?" I said, "Well, I said, it seems to me that one of the key issues is that there be women on the faculty at Princeton to whom these young women can see there's some point in getting a fine education. He said, well, he said, we don't think, Pearson never has had women on the faculty. And I said, I understood that. But I thought that now that I have women as students, it was probably time to think about women as faculty. Well, he said, we have very high standards. I said, well, I'm confident of that. And I said, what are the standards that you think of as being essential? Well, he said, we'd like a faculty member to have had a Rhodes Scholarship. I smiled as pleasantly as I knew how, and I said, well, you know, women are not eligible for Rhodes Scholarships, so that would seem to be an inappropriate expectation for women faculty. Oh, he said, I didn't know that. And I said, well, I said, what other things are you looking for? Well, he said, you know, major grants, Ford Foundation grants, Rockefeller Foundation grants, big grants. I said, all right. And I said, in what areas are you now looking for women, are you now searching for new faculty? And he reeled off about 8 or 10 different departments, you know, practically every place in the university. This was 69 and campuses were growing. I said, well, I said, let me think about this, and let me see if I can come up with any suggestions that would make it appropriate for you to consider women in any of these areas. I said, what rank are you looking for? Well, he said, mostly junior, but maybe senior. The previous spring, Princeton had promoted, the previous year, Princeton had promoted the longtime lecturer at Princeton, Suzanne Keller, who's a very well-known sociologist, had promoted her to professor. So they had taken the first steps, and then that fall, two new assistant professors came. A woman in Japanese who didn't stay very long and went to Michigan, and Nancy Weiss, who's now Nancy Weiss Malkiel. And Nancy's book talks about the woman in Japanese. And so they had known they were taking the first step. Well, after this conversation, I went across Nassau Street, bought a pair of shoes. I needed a pair of shoes. This is relevant. And it, of course, came in a box. And when I went home that evening, I got out my husband's IBM Key Sort cars, which were a kind of rectangular card that you could put a long pole through where you put holes in the top. It's a preliminary form of sorting before you had computers. And so I set up my shoebox with these cards in it in different fields for all the areas in which Princeton was looking for faculty. And then I made a search of Guggenheim recipients, Ford Foundation faculty grant, grants, Carnegie had some, Rockefeller had more, and then a survey of some federal grants from the National Institutes of Health. And I looked for the women. And I made a card for each woman with her baccalaureate, her PhD, and subject of study, and organized them by disciplines. And, you know, it took me a while to do that. But a few days later, I went to see the dean of the faculty, and I brought him the box. And I said, now, I don't know whether any of these are right for your searches, but this is an example of women with the criteria you indicated were necessary for Princeton. And it was a full shoebox.
So you created the database.
So I didn't know it was a database then.
Right,
but what I wanted to do was show that there were a lot of women who were who had met the criteria that he had indicated. Now, of course, I knew that they, within fields, they had much more specific notions. Well, he showed this to the new provost. Princeton had a new provost that year, and that new provost was Bill Bowen. Oh, he said, who is this woman? So Bill was the person in charge of, as provost. He was, of course, would make final, he would participate in making final decisions about faculty, but he was primarily concerned with the non-faculty issues of women students. And he had two absolutely spectacular women with whom he worked on that. Halsey Bowen, who was the assistant dean of students, and Mary Proctor, who worked directly for Bill. And Halsey's business were the women students. And Mary's business was everything else, which included, she spent a lot of time on facilities, and women's bathrooms and other kinds of facilities. But, so then Bill suggested that I join, when they had meetings, that I join because I was interested. It became clear to me that what I could do was to say something about women faculty and also discuss the question of whether or not it was necessary to add more art history, because now we were going to have women, and whether home economics would be necessary. We didn't think so. And whether the, you would need to up certain disciplines that women were likely to take. And I was against that. I thought that the trick for Princeton was to give the girls the same excellent education in all fields that they gave the boys, and not to preclude or presuppose that girls would be interested in different subjects than the boys. This, after all, was Princeton. This was not an A&M institution that was supposed to serve the state. Princeton, you know, was our nation, serving our nation. That was the gist of the work that we did.
So it sounds like there was an idea at the time that there would need to be some academic changes to the departments because there would be women centering.
Well, not so much to the departments as it was that you would need to add new subjects that would be of deeper mm-hmm. interest to women.
Okay.
And, you know, I'd been at Columbia. I grew up on a college town in West Lafayette, Indiana, Purdue University. Purdue was a very different kind of institution than Princeton. But I'd been at Columbia, you know, by this time I'd been a graduate student there and had been teaching there for about about 5 years. And because I started in 65 as an assistant professor. And I was teaching mostly at Barnard, but I also taught, and my courses were cross-listed in the history department at Columbia. So my husband was at Columbia, and I'd been a graduate student at Columbia, so I knew Columbia by that time pretty well. And I had just survived the Columbia Revolution in the spring of 68, which brought up lots of questions about campus governance and so on. And I was very concerned about opportunities for women. And being at Barnard, I had a lot of opportunity to see young women students. And I was struck by what I thought at the time was the isolation of Princeton and the Princeton faculty from the broader academic community. They were highly specialized with excellent reputations in their fields, but sort of the robust activities of the world were not nearly as evident at Princeton as they were in New York City. And, of course, probably New York was the far end of the spectrum for that sort of thing.
Right.
And Columbia had just gone through this big crisis in 68 and had shaken everything up. And Princeton had disturbances also in 70 and I believe 71. But none of that was all much more genteel.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that there weren't very smart people there, but they were not as much of the world as Columbia was and as New York City was. And the opportunity for women to have independent professional lives wasn't anywhere near as evident in Princeton as it was in New York City. So that meant that the opportunities for women were going to be more genteel, but also more challenging at Princeton. So it seemed to me that the crucial thing for Princeton was to get tenured women with a dose of feminism. And it was good to, maybe you had to get assistant professors first, maybe you had to grow your own, but you needed to get not just women who were excellent scholars, but also women who were alert to the issues of what was then very active women's movement nationally.
Mm-hmm. Was your sense that some of these differences at Princeton had to do with the location, where it was?
Partly, but it was also particularly with the culture. I mean, any university that had Woodrow Wilson as a president who had said that he would teach at Bryn Mawr but would not report to a woman administrator, you knew that was going to be troublesome for women on the faculty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Suzanne Keller was very important. And Nancy, as she came up the ranks as an assistant professor, was a very attractive, young, single, personable individual. Of course, she married later, but I think she married when she was a full professor. It was easier to take a young, single woman than it was to take a person who came in, a woman who came in with tenure and with the assumption that she, her ideas were as good as any other tenured professor of English or history or whatever it might be.
Right. So it was easier to take junior faculty.
Yeah, yeah. But crucially, you needed to take senior faculty.
What was your sense of some of the real reasons why there weren't more women faculty at that time? They had only done a couple of these hires. It sounds like from your conversation with the dean of the faculty, the reason was really about these criteria.
I think the criteria, the simplest criteria, were that we want men. We want excellent men. And that it's just not appropriate to have women.
Correct.
And that it's, if the women want to teach, they should go teach in some nice place like Smith. Or if they're really serious, then they can teach at Bryn Mawr. And then, of course, if they're a little ragtag, they can teach at Marner. One of the first appointments they made, which they did not do well, they did not treat the person well, was the Dorothy Ross appointment. Do you know about Dorothy Ross?
No, I don't.
Have you ever heard of Dorothy Ross? Dorothy Ross retired as the Lovejoy professor at Johns Hopkins. Johns Hopkins, I think even Princeton would believe, was a fine university. And she is a professor of American history, American social and intellectual history. She and I were graduate students together at Columbia in the 60s when she was writing on G. Stanley Hall, who was an early American psychologist, and I was writing on progressive education and the ideas behind it, of which G. Stanley Hall was important. So we have known each other forever. Like me, she was married early. Lots of people did that in the 50s. And unlike me, she didn't have any children yet. Her husband was a working lawyer. My husband was a graduate student. So there were certain differences. She had gone to Smith and had been editor of the student newspaper at Smith. I had gone to Purdue. My husband had been editor of the student newspaper at Purdue, and I had worked as a junior member of the staff. She was from Milwaukee. She was Jewish. I was from Indiana, and old line Protestant and Danish immigrant family. We connected. In the late 60s, early 70s, at the annual conventions of the AHA and American Book of Science Association, MLA, all these outfits, women were standing up at these annual meetings that were usually held over the Christmas holidays, and complaining about the fact that the profession was not taking them seriously. Well, these mealy-mouthed historians and English professors and so on did not like being assaulted by these women whom they had always been taught to be gracious to and condescending to while being gracious. And the AHA appointed a committee on the status of women in 1969, the year I was at Princeton. And it had, let's see if I can remember who all the people were. Carl Shorsky, who of course ultimately went to Princeton, wonderful man. Paige Smith, who was an American historian at Santa Cruz. Hannah Gray, who was a had just gotten tenure, very recently gotten tenure at Chicago. Of course, became president of the University of Chicago. Willie Mae Rose and me. And I was an add-on when the woman at Yale, Mary Wright, died before the committee met. And so they thought, well, we have to add one more. And they said, well, we'll get Pat Graham from Princeton. Well, I wasn't from Princeton. I was from Harvard. We all met, and in the face of all of these uprisings at the meeting, we knew that this was not helping the cause. So this was an interim committee. It wrote a report on women historians, which is actually quite interesting. And then Willie Mae had a stroke and was hospitalized the rest of her life. Wonderful, wonderful woman. And a permanent committee was created with me as the chair. And the management of the AHA was very concerned about how the women would erupt at the next meeting. So I met with my little committee, and I said, we don't get any benefit out of these eruptions for women faculty. I said, what we really need is somebody in the AHA staff who is paying attention to issues of women, who will make sure that women are included on the programs and included in all the activities of the AHA and give women a chance. And I said, why don't we go to the management of the AHA and say, we will be sure, we will deal with all the different factions that there be no eruptions at the AHA meeting if you guarantee a halftime position at the AHA. Well, there was a huffing and a puffing, and they said, okay. They said, and then we said, we have the candidate. The candidate is Dorothy Ross. This is a long way to get around to Dorothy Ross, but it's slightly relevant, and that period, it's indicative of the times.
Is this 1970?
Yeah, this is 69-70. And I, of course, had already talked to Dorothy, and she had two little children. Her husband was a very successful lawyer in Washington, and she agreed. And she did this for 2 or 3 years until both children were in kindergarten, a boy and a girl. And then she was ready to look for a job. And she was offered an assistant professorship in the Princeton History Department. For her to take this job involved her commuting from Washington to Princeton and getting adequate daycare in Washington for her children, with her husband in residence and their father in Washington. She did that. She was turned down for tenure. Because she didn't fit in. Well, of course she didn't fit in. And she went on to become an endowed chair at the University of Virginia, and where she commuted instead of Washington to Princeton. It was now Washington to Charlottesville, which is more difficult to move. And then she got this really fancy chair at Johns Hopkins. The Lovejoy chair is one of the most famous history chairs. And that was an early example of course, I was well out of there by then. I was here when that all happened in the mid-70s. But it is an example of Princeton having difficulty making an accommodation to somebody who wasn't just like one of the boys.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the fact that she was so highly regarded subsequently is an example of every university and every department makes mistakes. But this, to me, has always been a very telling mistake. See, she didn't act like Nancy Weiss. Nancy Weiss was excellent, absolutely superb at fitting in and never causing any trouble. Dorothy was strong-minded, very competent, and did not fit in. And that seems to me to, I thought it was essential to have these women faculty with a little dose of feminism. But I did not realize how difficult it was going to be for a professional woman with family to make the grade. Another woman who had trouble at Princeton, whom I also knew well, was Dina Garcia, who briefly was dean of the graduate school. Now, she didn't have any family, and she didn't have any children. She's Armenian, expert in medieval Armenian history, very smart. She taught at Smith for a long time, then she taught at Columbia, and then she didn't work out at Princeton, she went back to Columbia. But it was not easy for these strong-minded women, without the special grace that Nancy had, to manage.
And because the tenure process is also so opaque, it can be difficult to really know. I mean, was that the reason that was given, that she didn't fit in?
No, of course not. The reason was inadequate scholarship.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But this your scholarship is always inadequate.
Right.
Against some ultimate standard.
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Gorsayan was a administrative appointment, and so they just didn't renew her, and she decided she wanted to go back to New York, where her mother lived and her friends were.
Yeah, there are unwritten rules.
Oh yeah, but you got to be sharp to understand those, and because ordinarily they're never explained to you.
Right.
And you have to be able to pick up on that.
Yeah, it's interesting. The history department in particular, it seems there have been a number of cases of people who were turned out for tenure who went on to illustrious careers.
Right. Well, I think it was, the history department is an illustrious department.
Of course. Mm-hmm.
And but it's very hard for senior administration to clean house when you have a strong department, but it's a little rigid.
Of course, right. Mm. That's always a struggle.
Because you want the strong department.
Yeah.
For sure you want that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like you didn't have almost any contact with Princeton before you arrived there.
Zero. I'd never been to Princeton.
Did you have any expectations of what Princeton would be like?
Not really.
Especially knowing you were going into work.
I thought it was just extremely convenient that since my husband's going to be at the Institute for Advanced Study and our daughter was going to be finishing elementary school, this was a great time to get out of New York for a year. I mean, the previous is 68. The spring of 68 at Columbia had been tumultuous in the extremes. So 68-69 was an extremely difficult year at Columbia, and commencement was disrupted yet again. So the idea of getting out of New York and being in some leafy place that had a great university in it, I was writing my second book, and that had to do with educational opportunity called Community and Class in American Education, in which I argued that the social class you were born into and the community in which you live were primary determinants of your educational opportunity. It's an old story but it wasn't such an old story then. And that therefore where you live, the community where you live, was a very important determinant because you only move for education for college. So I wrote about four counties in the United States, and I was going to do Amherst and the University of Wisconsin as the two colleges. Well, I ended up doing Princeton instead, Princeton and the University of Wisconsin, and didn't do Amherst. So I found Princeton very convenient from that point of view.
So it was a great place to write?
Yeah, if they weren't going to, I understood that they might not want to have anything to do with me. Because I represented something that a lot of people at Princeton didn't want. I mean, the idea to go co-ed was not universally acclaimed at Princeton, particularly by some of the alumni, but some of the existing faculty and administration. And I knew that for somebody like the dean of faculty who was busy with dean of faculty business, the idea of a woman who was trying to talk to him about how he could change his procedures was not welcome. And so connecting with Bowen, who was interested in co-education, after all he'd gone to Denison, it was a co-ed school. I don't know where Lester had gone, but it hadn't had a beneficial effect on his views, I think. And he's a very nice man. He's a labor economist. I don't want to demean him, just that this was not a primary interest of his. But Bowen had, you know, his two girls, Housie and Mary, and now he's adding a third girl, Pat. And we had, with him, we had rousing discussions. And Halsey and Mary were very concerned about the other support systems the university need to have in place for the women students. And I was very concerned about the academic environment in which women students would work and what you needed to bolster that for the women students and what was really a boys' club.
From your point of view, coming from Barnard, how was the climate at Princeton different at that time for women?
Well, I'll give you one anecdote. In those days, I'm sure this is not the case now, but in those days when you wanted to get an ID card as a faculty member or a member of the administration, you went to the Princeton University store. And at the store, you went and you lined up, and they issued you the ID card as a member of the Princeton community, and that you also used as your charge card at the Princeton University store. So it was a long line of men, and I waited in the line, and I listened to, you know, I was trying to pay attention, figure out what goes on here, how does this thing work. And I realized that after the men got their card, then they were asked, do you want one for your wife? Which the answer was yes. So the wife could go shopping, too. So it came my turn. And I was asked, what part of Princeton are you working? What is your department at Princeton? And I said, I'm an administrative intern in the president's office, because technically that's what I was. And they said, oh, yes, and they looked at their list, and my name was there, fortunately. And so they printed me my card, Patricia A. Graham. And then I said, I'd like one for my husband, too. They said, what? I said, I'd like one for my husband, too, please. Well, what department is he in at Princeton? I said, he's not at Princeton. He's not at Princeton. Well, then what does he do? But this time, the rancor was rising. I said, he collects details and garbage. You know, that's what historians do. He was at the Institute for Advanced Study, of course, and he was a professor at Columbia. But I wasn't about to say any of that. So then the man went to the back room, and he stayed there a very long time, and everybody behind me was tapping their feet and getting very anxious. And eventually he came out and he gave me a card. You know what it said? Mr. Patricia A. Graham.
Oh, my God.
My husband has kept his card as a collection, which amused him very much. But that was an example of, at that time, it was an example of the culture of the place. And at that time, women were not permitted to eat in the dining room of the the faculty dining room was. A big, very nice faculty dining room.
Was it in Prospect House? Or that?
I don't know. I don't remember. I knew then, but I don't remember now. One of the things that Bowen and this little trio of the girls changed was to say that women could be entertained. When I came to Harvard, I couldn't enter the front. This time I was a tenured professor. I came to Harvard with tenure. And I couldn't enter the main door of the faculty club. There was a women's dining room, and they had to go in the back entrance and enter the women's dining room. You couldn't eat in the main dining room.
What year is that?
I came in 74.
That's incredible.
So, you know, Christian was not alone in these practices.
Right. And so that was my other question. I wonder, coming, like, after your experience at Princeton, and then eventually when you went to Harvard a few years later, was there a big difference in the climate between Princeton and Harvard for women?
No, not between, but the big difference was that Harvard had an ostensible women's college, namely Radcliffe, but Radcliffe had never had its own faculty. And you paid most of the, in the old days, a number of the Harvard faculty were men of wealth. Not all, but a good many. And to make extra money, a Harvard faculty member who needed extra money would come over and teach the same class at Radcliffe that he had taught at Harvard. And during World War II, in the 40s, more classes opened up for Radcliffe students in the Harvard Yard because many of the male faculty were in World War II, and that changed. But that changed things somewhat. But the fact that Radcliffe had never had a faculty meant that it never really existed as a college. It existed as a bunch of kindly lady administrators and sometimes a male president, unlike Smith or Barnard or Lamar or Wellesley or Mount Holyoke or whatever.
Okay.
Bastard.
And Princeton didn't even have that.
Now, Princeton had. With Evelyn College, Princeton had it, but Evelyn, most people didn't know that Evelyn College had ever existed.
Right.
That's one of the things that, one of the reasons that I found out when I was doing research on the history of Princeton before I got engaged with Bill and the girls.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about that. So you mentioned a little bit some of the people you worked with.
Yeah.
What were the concerns that they had at that time? So what sort of accommodations were they discussing in the administration?
Well, they had to make fast decisions about housing. And they had where they wanted the girls to live. The undergraduates to live. So housing was a big issue. And for Housley, the mental health and the physical health of the undergraduates was a big issue. And Housley turned out in later life to be a therapist. And these were natural abilities that she put to use at Princeton, but she at that time was not, I don't believe she had any of her therapeutic training. She was married at that time to her husband, and they subsequently divorced. He subsequently announced himself as gay. And she had a number of experiences. They had three or four children before all this happened, and she became a very well-known, very highly respected therapist in Washington, D.C., but she brought to the Dean of Students' Office a concern for what happens to the girls with, I suspect, a special concern for those who were traumatized by their experience at Princeton.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the woman who was dean of the Radcliffe Institute was in Princeton's first group of women students, Elizabeth Cohen, and her close friend was Deborah Leff, somebody should talk to both of them about what it was like to be in the first cohort of women students. Deborah Leff went on to become the head of the Spencer Foundation, and she was head of another foundation, and now she worked in the government for a while with Larry Tribe in the Obama administration. Larry Tribe is a Harvard lawyer, fancy Harvard lawyer, liberal. And now she's working with Brian Stevenson, who is a black activist, very well-known black activist, has an honorary degree from Harvard, in Montgomery, Alabama, creating museums, testifying to black experience in Alabama. So both Debbie Leff and Elizabeth Cohen would be very good people for you to follow up with, and from that first cohort. I did not know either of them because I was not. The girls were Housley's responsibility.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Was there any conversation about graduate students, women graduate students?
There was a little. There had been Princeton women students in critical languages. You know, Russian was a critical language then.
Sure.
again, and now, excuse me. And there were language instructors in these critical languages who were women, but they were not thought of as real faculty. And the graduate students were, on the whole, mostly ignored. At least to me. They may not have been ignored by their department or by their major professor, but the undergraduates were the new thing, and they were what was transforming the university.
Of course.
In this way.
And there are much fewer numbers.
That's right. That's right. And of course, you know that, I'm sure you've read, that Princeton, like Harvard, the big impetus to go co-ed was not because they wanted to educate women students, but because their best male applicants were not selected, their best male selected new students were not choosing Princeton. They were going to places where there were girls.
Okay.
And that's deep in the documents around the co-education issue. And that's true at Harvard as well. And I suspect there's a new book out on co-education at Yale, and it certainly was true at Yale.
So it's really an issue of competing with other institutions.
Competing for the best boys at other institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was very evident when you were there, that was the reason they were letting in the girls, was so they could get the best boys.
Mm-hmm.
There we are.
Wow, yeah. It's very interesting to think about all this history, you know, as someone who's been at the institution right now.
Yes.
What are the legacies of this that show up?
Well, of course, Princeton did very well in getting good women faculty and getting a woman president before anybody else did.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, Nancy Weiss, Malkiel, is, as you, I'm sure you know, is now writing a biography of Bill Bowen, and that will be of interest.
Very, very much so, right. It's interesting, so one of my history students is valedictorian this year.
Yeah.
She'll be giving the history address. Catherine Reed, she's a Rhodes Scholar. So it's very interesting to hear your reflections on that. She's a brilliant, brilliant student, studies Mexican history, and I've known her since her first year,
and
so that's been very exciting. But just thinking about where we are now.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. Scholar. I mean, I think Princeton is one of the great cases of success.
Right.
And I should make that very clear, that they were always remarkably good, excellent university, but they carried through the co-education, I think, with greater skill than the other institutions. I should add one other thing, that while this was all going on, and while I was at Princeton in my sort of lend-lease capacity, Yale, of course, was undergoing co-education for the first time. And Radcliffe was negotiating with Harvard about merger with Mary Bunting, Polly Bunting. That is less well known. But there's a good deal of evidence of that. What I have been told with what they say are reliable sources, but which I have not documented myself by searching in the Harvard archives, is that the day of the bust for the students here at Harvard who were occupying University Hall and, you know, causing great difficulty, was the day that Polly Bunting, Mary I. Bunting, had a meeting with Nathan Pusey, the president of Harvard, to finalize details of the Harvard-Radcliffe merger. This I have not, as I repeat, I have not documented. But it is widely believed to be the case by people who pay attention.
Hi,
how are you? And you probably have to get into the archives to get that. And the 50-year rule isn't quite up yet. So
what year would that have been?
1969. Okay. It's about up though.
Yeah, almost there. Okay.
And so. Elga Wasserman, who was doing the job at Yale, got in touch with me because she heard I was at Princeton as some sort of ad hoc person at Princeton. And Elga had gone to Radcliffe and a PhD from Radcliffe before Harvard gave women PhDs. And she knew Polly, who was a, Elga Wasserman was a chemist. Polly was a biologist. I'm, of course, a hopeless historian. And she suggested that the three of us get together periodically during that year to discuss what was going on in the different campuses. Now, of course, my situation at Princeton was that I was just there as a visitor for the year. I was not part of the structure. And they were both part of the structure of their two institutions. But we met, I don't know how often, maybe five or six times during the year to discuss these, to discuss what was going on our different campuses and to share ideas and strategies and so on. And I've given my papers to the Harvard Archive. I don't recall that I had any papers that dealt with this, but the new history of, it's basically of coeducation at Yale, which is just coming out by a woman who's a doctoral dissertation that she did. Spends a lot of time on Elga Wasserman's papers and talks about the fact that Elga was meeting with me and with Polly Bunting about these issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, after you left Princeton, was there someone who was eventually built into the structure who took on your responsibility?
I don't know. The person who would know about that is Nancy Weiss.
Okay.
But Nancy was still in the, she wasn't in the administration yet. And there were women who came in as assistant dean of the graduate school, which was not the same level of position. But there were women in those jobs. That was sort of became the women's job. And then there was a women dean of students was named, and that was Adele Simmons, who went on to become president of Hampshire College, and then the president of the MacArthur Foundation, a very illustrious career, now in Chicago. And she was hired after Halsey. When Halsey and her husband went to Washington, she was hired. I don't know what year that was, but that's an important name to keep track of.
Okay. Let me ask you about UNOW. So how did you first hear about UNOW? Remember?
It was just one of, I think of it as one of Mary's projects, because it was not central to me for women faculty, because I thought there weren't enough women faculty to justify a daycare center. But did I think daycare was important? Absolutely. I mean, you know, I had lived through, I entered a PhD program with a two-year-old, and my husband was in a PhD program. I mean, you can imagine, I was teaching, I was the chairman of the history department in New York City High School at the time.
Oh, wow. So how did you manage childcare?
The New York City High School had a daycare program, and up to that point, I'd been a teacher of English and with a minor in history. And the high school needed an English person, needed a history person, not an English person. And I said, I will be a history person if you take the baby in the nursery. She said she has to be toilet trained. I said she will be. And mercifully, she was. But, I mean, I understood the daycare problem absolutely. So I thought the idea that they are going to have daycare is fabulous. But in terms of I didn't want to get involved. They were doing fine getting their daycare going. And they didn't need me other than just to be, you know, clapping my hands in the background. I was worried about a completely different issue. Although I understood that the daycare would be a help to Princeton if it ever got around to hiring women faculty with small children.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But, of course, that was not whom... Oh, the Japanese woman, the woman in Japanese study, whose name was Karen Brazel. She, her, I think it's B-R-A-Z-E-L-L. And she had small children, and she was facing this issue. But if you only had one woman faculty facing this issue, that was, I wasn't going to let go of the broader question of getting more women faculty and women administrators.
And in terms of the child care.
Most of the early women did not have children, small children.
So that's what I was wondering. Then having the daycare, did that become part of sort of an incentive for women faculty to come to work?
I was not there by that time because, you see, I was gone by the time they got the daycare.
Okay.
I mean, I was interested in supporting it, but I don't have evidence about what happened next.
Right, yeah. You were there for this very important
The beginning, right. The beginning, but not... Nancy could probably tell you about that, but, of course, Nancy was not interested in it. Daycare was not a personal interest for her.
Yeah.
And I believe that it's the case that it was for Karen, and one of the reasons she left to go to Michigan was she thought it was going to be easier. But I could be wrong about that.
So in your article in Science, Women in Academia, you have a section on daycare centers.
Yeah.
One of the things that really struck me is you refer to the idea that these centers should serve women across the university,
right.
So not just faculty,
right.
Graduate students,
right.
Even staff.
Thinking of my own difficulties.
Of course, food service workers, and you said earlier, I think something about sort of growing your own. And this idea of how do we have more women faculty?
Yeah.
Well, part of the idea is creating a pathway,
right.
Pipeline for graduate students to actually be able to enter the professorate.
Right.
So was that, in the conversations that you were privy to about the daycare center, was that a consideration?
Oh, yeah. My recollection, this is 50 years ago, and I, it's fair to say that in the intervening 50 years, I have not been constantly revisiting my wonderful year at Princeton. but, of course, I had it in 1970. I had a 13-year-old, and it would be, she no longer needed daycare. But I remembered vividly I took the job at that high school because, I switched my identity from being an English person to a history person. And in order to get daycare for her. So it was that's a big thing.
Which high school was that?
St. Helens and St. Hughes.
Okay.
I was offered a job in the New York City High School in Far Rockaway. But the idea of going to Far Rockaway from the Upper West Side of Manhattan with an 18-month-old child was not it. And St. Hills and St. Hughes was on 111th Street between Broadway and Riverside Drive.
Okay.
That was a whole lot more convenient.
Right. These are important considerations.
Yes,
absolutely.
Of course, my husband had a fellowship. He actually had two, but he only got money for one, Woodrow Wilson and Danforth. And it wasn't enough to live on for a family of three.
Did your position pay well as an administrative intern?
No. I mean, I don't remember what it paid, but I think it, I don't have any idea. But when my husband got tenure at Columbia, he did not negotiate salary. He negotiated an apartment with rent control. Because we lived in New York long enough to know that that was the thing.
That was very valuable.
Yeah. And we got one on 116th Street between Broadway and Riverside on Claremont Avenue, which was walking distance to the Meg's, their daughter's school, and where I was by that time. I was teaching at Barnard, but I became the guidance counselor for the school, so after I quit teaching there, after I was the head of the history department, and as the guidance counselor, I got free tuition. No money, but free tuition. Well, of course, that was
worth it.
I mean, it was... And so I had the usual experiences of a woman of my generation who is married, is a mother, and has a professional career, mm-hmm. and does not have much money, and didn't come from a family of money.
Yeah.
So, you know, I couldn't call up my great aunt and say, oh, Angie.
Could you tell me a little bit about what you remember as your relationship to feminism at that time? Like, what was your opinion of now, for example?
Oh, I have to tell you a little about my mother. My mother married this Danish immigrant man whose English was accented, whom she met in a PhD seminar with Carl Russell Fish at the University of Wisconsin. She had lost her fiancé in World War I, and her brother, who was a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, told her that, she said, I'll never marry, having lost my fiancé. Her brother said, She taught history in a high school in Indiana, and she hated that. She wasn't good at dealing with discipline and that kind of thing. And, of course, if you teach high school, you got to figure that out. So her brother said, come and live with us in Madison and get a PhD, and then you can be a college teacher. And as you probably know, the rate of women getting PhDs in the 20s was higher than it was until the 70s, which is a remarkable figure. Of course, the numbers was much smaller, and of course, it was PhDs opened up dramatically after World War II and the GI Bill. Anyway, there was a man in her seminar with Carl Russell Fish that was interested in her. And so after one seminar meeting, it was winter in Madison, and have you ever been to the Wisconsin campus?
I haven't.
There's a big hill that overlooks a lake, and there was ski jumps set up there. And so this young man who needed to make an impression on this woman in the seminar said, come with me, and would you like to see me jump off the ski, go off the ski jump? And she said, oh, yes. And so he saw some guy who just was good. He said, may I borrow your skis? Of course, in those days, male graduate students wore a suit. So wearing his suit and tie and his only pair of shoes, he went off the ski jump, magical ski jump, without falling, and skied way out in the lake and came back, and my mother was smitten. She got her PhD before he did, because she'd been ahead of him in school, and in terms of, you know, he'd been in World War I. And got a job teaching. She wanted to get a job in the Seven Sisters with her Wisconsin PhD, but guess what? She hadn't gone to a Seven Sisters college. And her PhD was from Wisconsin. And Wisconsin was a good history department, but, you know, it wasn't Yale. It wasn't Johns Hopkins. It wasn't Radcliffe.
The faculty at those schools had all gone to those schools.
Pretty much gone to those schools, or who had family connections, who were known as important people. So she went. She became the head of the history department at Alabama College for Women. It's a white school, segregated white school. And she published. And my father got his degree, got a job at Purdue, felt that he had to pay off his debt before he could get married. This was the old days. And they married, and she moved from being the head of the history department at Alabama State College for Women to Purdue. At the beginning of the Depression. And, of course, Purdue was not hiring. And West Lafayette is in the far reaches of nowhere in northwestern Indiana. And then she had she lost three children at childbirth, which was a tragedy. And she and my father wrote a big history from Sedan to Stracy. In those days, undergraduates had big history textbooks. They wrote one of those. She became pregnant again. And, of course, they feared that she would lose this baby, too. But then I arrived healthy as a horse.
Here you are.
And, of course, that was very surprising.
Wow.
I was born in 35. And which was still the depth of the Depression. And so they were writing the history book because there were no jobs. World War II came along. They, of course, expected me to die at any moment. They couldn't understand why I continued to live, but I did. And my father got over that. My mother remained more concerned about this matter. And when World War II hit, my father was too old for World War II, but a lot of men who were teaching at Purdue were not, and they were immediately sucked up into the military. And so they asked my mother to teach sociology. Now, my mother had never studied sociology. She had a perfectly good PhD in history, but nothing in sociology. But she was smart, and she was a good teacher, and she was an informed person. She was writing this book. It was a history book, but, you know, she was competent. So she taught sociology all through World War II. When the soldiers came home, she was fired. She ran the quiz sections for the people teaching government who did not have PhDs. I was growing up in this household. You can imagine that my mother was not happy in these circumstances. My mother believed that she was not treated honestly or accurately. Then about the time I was ready to graduate from high school, I dropped out of high school when I had enough credits to graduate. I told the principal I was 16. I had enough credits. I didn't need to stay in high school. And I went to work as a secretary for the Agricultural Economics Department in the hope that I could make enough money that if I got a scholarship, I could go away to school. I wanted out of Purdue. And my mother got a job in the Dean of Women's Office, where she was, and she wasn't hired because she had a PhD, although they probably didn't hurt. She hired because all the other women were single, most of them lesbian. We didn't know that. We didn't say that at the time. And they wanted one married woman with a child in the Dean of Women's Office who could speak to the parents of the girls who were in trouble. And so I took all this in as a child. My mother continued to publish, but she became embittered. And you can understand why she was embittered. And
did she teach history?
Never at Purdue. Never. Only at Alabama. And she taught all these other subjects at Purdue. Political science, sociology, I think even economics at one point. But Purdue didn't even have a history department. They had what they called the social sciences. So history, economics, philosophy, political science, sociology. And I took that in, and then I, when my father got sick my freshman year in college, my mother couldn't cope and said I needed to come home and help take care of him. Well, of course, he got better on his own, but the fact was I had to transfer out of Wisconsin, which I loved, and was a very, it's called the Integrated Liberal Studies Program. It was a great, great program for 90 college freshmen who were selected, and I got into it. Then I left, came back. My father got, well, fine. But I was mad as a wet hen at the idea of coming back to Purdue. So, and I was in a sorority, and I didn't want to be in that sorority. So on the night that they had meetings on Monday night, on the first Monday, I went to work on the student newspaper. And as, you know, a sophomore who was the most junior member. And there I was assigned to work with the night editor, who was a boy, who was a junior. And I did. And it's Lauren Graham, who became my husband. And pretty soon, we got seriously involved. I was 18. He was 20. My mother thought that this was a very bad idea. I thought if I can get out of West Lafayette, I want to live with this man. I didn't know how to live with somebody unless you married them. That was the era, 55. So I left. I rushed through and I graduated the end of my junior year, the end of the senior year we left, he was in the Navy. We were in debt. We were in debt the amount of my first year teacher salary, which is what the average student debt is now. Now that's $33,000. Then it was $2,500. And so I taught high school English with history on the side. Was fired at the end of the year because I was pregnant and I would be a bad influence on the girls in my class, three of whom in my ninth grade homeroom had gotten pregnant before me. And that was a complete, that was just a complete falsehood. And my husband got in the Hungarian Revolution crisis and the Suez crisis in 56. His ship went to sea and they were gone for 6 months while I was pregnant with his baby, and I was then fired. I knew I couldn't get another job. Well, what could you do? You'd get a master's degree. I mean, why not get a master's degree? So I went back to Purdue, lived with my parents, and while I was pregnant, went to summer school, went to the fall term. The baby was born in January, and I got a master's degree in English and guidance because you couldn't get a straight English degree at Purdue. And I wrote a thesis, so I didn't have to write, so I didn't have to go to any more classes after the baby was born. So I had a master's degree. Fine. But all of this had taught me that there were incredible inequities between women and men. And the experiences of my mother was deep in my soul. The way that I was treated, in which they wouldn't ask boys to have done what they asked me to do. And I thought, there's something rotten in Denmark. When my husband then applied for fellowships to take his chemical engineering degree and his 3 years as an active duty Navy officer to enter a Russian history PhD program, it was evident that as I helped him, in fact, filled out much of the applications for all this, applied to 9 graduate schools, was denied admission to 7, and admitted by 2, Harvard and Columbia, which were then the 2 best Russian history programs in the country. And that was, of course, an example of universities that had great confidence in their ability to weed out the trash, saying, we'll take some unusual guy, and if he doesn't make it, we'll get rid of him. And, you know, Indiana thought he has to have an undergraduate degree. So we moved to New York. I had to get a job, and hence I had to have daycare, which is the daycare part. I watched what happened to how he was treated and how I was treated. And one of the fellowships she had was the Danforth Fellowship, which was her men only, who wanted to become college teachers. And he got one of those. And I read the booklet, and it said many of our Danforth fellows marry too young and outgrow their wives intellectually and divorce them. We do not believe in divorce. Consequently, we will pay the tuition for a wife to take a college course or university course as a Danforth fellow so that she will not be outgrown by him. Yeah, look at that. I thought, well, here I am teaching history. I don't know much history. I'm at a university that has a wonderful history department. I'll never be at a place like that again. Let me see if I can take a history course. So I said to Lon, I need to take a history course. When can you pick up the baby in the nursery school? What afternoon can you pick up the baby in the nursery school? Thursday, he said. Columbia offered one course on Thursday afternoon. It was a course on the social and historical background of American education. It was given in the history department by somebody I'd never heard of, and I was a little apprehensive because he had an office at Teachers College, and I knew that wasn't really history. But he was a member of the history department his first year. So I enrolled in that course. His name was Lawrence Kremen, who became a well-known historian of American education, and I became a historian with a PhD in history of education.
Here you are.
But what that series of biographical steps made me acutely aware of the difference between my husband's trajectory as a graduate student and mine. And I was delighted that he got along so well, and everybody thought he was so great and made all these arrangements for him and gave him fellowships. I thought that was fabulous. But I could see that I didn't get any of that, and that I attributed at least some of that, not just to the fact that I was not as smart as he, but to the fact that I was a woman. And so that made it crystal clear to me, and I thought, that's not fair. It is simply not fair. And I have a great belief in fairness.
Absolutely. And then all of these issues were just baked into your origins,
yeah,
like going back
yeah,
to your mother
yeah,
and your father.
Yeah. By the way, we found out why she lost those babies. Because she was Rh negative, and my father was Rh positive and blood type, and they hadn't figured that out in Lafayette, Indiana, and I didn't figure that out until I was pregnant.
Wow.
So it was no fault of hers,
right?
Which she knew before she died, which was good.
You know, it strikes me too. It's a wonderful opportunity with the Danforth Fellowship. That it's we should educate women so that they will be better partners to men.
Yeah,
this will benefit
yeah,
men.
The man.
The
it's not mine.
We want to do co-education.
Right.
We want to bring women
yes.
so it'll
yes.
be a better environment.
I didn't have any doubt about any of that.
Right. I mean, it's very good. And of course, take the opportunity. Anyway,
yeah, sure.
But it's. Yeah,
but, I mean, that's what you say. How did this come about? I mean, I figured out very early on that these wonderful things that were happening to me were subsidiary to what was happening to somebody else.
How did you feel about that?
Well, I thought it was unjust.
Yeah.
I thought, and it was the basis for my recognizing, I think, broader injustice in the society, so that I was very concerned about how blacks were treated, because I lost my second job when in Norfolk, Virginia, after I found daycare for the baby, when Norfolk closed its white high schools rather than admit any blacks in the desegregation issue. It closed all its schools, not elementary and high schools, and I was teaching English at Moy High School. And they closed rather than admit six blacks. So, and then, you know, when I got to New York and came back to New York, I looked poverty in the face. And that wasn't fair either. And pretty soon I realized that that's where the community and class book came from, that the community you grew up in, this was, you know, the middle 60s, the community in which you grew up shaped your education much more than your schooling did. It's not that we shouldn't have very good schools. Yes, of course we should. But you had to look at these other factors.
And so much of that inequality and injustice already baked in.
So I was part of a group of women historians in the 60s who met privately, and with the, including Gerda Lerner, whose name I'm sure you know. And she and I were graduate students at Columbia at the same time, and we were deviant in that we were women. And she was, of course, older than I, and she had many more experiences than I had had. But Sandy Cooper and Rosalind Rosenberg and a group of us met regularly, and Gerda was active in the more radical group of women historians, as well as in this small group. You know, we met in everybody's living room, and my friend Dorothy Ross was not part of that group, but we maintained those kinds of conversations, so... I was definitely part of the women's movement. I helped found the Barnard Women's Center, when women's centers were the thing to do. I was a good friend of Kate Millett's when her book Sexual Politics came out when the same month that my article in Science came out. And, you know, I was more establishment than she was. my friend Catherine Stimson, who taught English at Barnard, who was ultimately president of the MLA and ended up as a dean of the graduate school at NYU. They were more militant than I, but you know, I was married with children. They were not.
There's some material reality that changes.
And we kept going to Russia all the time,
yeah.
Which was not exactly, in those years, convenient for my work.
Of course.
But, and yet in the long run, it was very valuable.
Yeah. It's so striking as this whole history of your family and your own biography shaped so clearly.
Well, I think most people's biographies shape what they do, but we don't admit it.
Right, and many people don't have an awareness of that.
And I think it's, I was extremely fortunate to grow up in an academic family. Both my parents were historians, and while I didn't want to be a historian, I figured, well, if they can be historians, and my husband can go from chemical engineering to history, I can certainly go from English to history if they'll take the baby in the nursery.
Yeah.
So that was incredible social capital that I had that I didn't really realize, but I simply looked around me and I figured these other people can do that. I know how to work hard. I can do that too.
I'm curious about your perception of women in academia today, because you've seen such a long arc of change, right? Of course, always incomplete, unfulfilled. There's always more to do, but what is your sense of
that? Well, I think that the two biggest issues for women in academia today are the issue of children and the issue of the one you love, the adult you love, and figuring out how you resolve the opportunities for the one you love and for the children. Those are incomparably important issues, and your scholarship usually comes last. And it's much easier for women in the ranks where you don't have real institutional responsibility, although the work is hard, than it is when you start having real institutional responsibility. And then the one you love and your children have to fit into that set of responsibilities you have that cannot be compartmentalized. I think that's tough. And the answer for some women is simply to remain single. But, you know, that's not a real answer for most people. It may be an answer for some. That's fine. But it's not an answer for everybody. And most of us want someone to love. And it affects some men as well. But it affects women. First of all, the men don't have the babies still. It's a really tough problem. And I have been extraordinarily lucky in this regard. And I was extraordinarily lucky at the age of 18 to recognize that this boy I was going out with was a lifetime's work.
Yeah.
Just incredibly lucky. And I was also extremely lucky that he got this fellowship that allowed me to take a course. And I was very unlucky when he went to Indiana University and I was denied a teaching position in the university because husbands and wives could not teach in the same department, history, and the School of Education thought I was too liberal artsy to be suitable for the School of Education, not professional enough. Well, they were right about that. But then eventually, when he got an offer from Hopkins, and he wanted to stay at Indiana, his dean told the dean of the School of Education he had to hire me. So I was hired not on my merit, but because my husband was offered a job at a better university and was willing to stay at the lesser university if his wife would get to be happier.
Sure. The position for your spouse being part of the negotiation.
That's right. And I was dealing with the School of Education here for 10 years. And I've been in many negotiations around those issues. But it's tough. I think it's really tough for a young woman entering a field. And, you know, it nearly broke my mother. You don't want to see people have to put up with that kind of difficulty. When Princeton decided to go co-ed, I suspect that 95% of the people in responsible positions at Princeton had never thought about these kinds of questions. Because they hadn't had to. There were probably Lemonek had. After all, he was with the dean of the graduate school, there were women graduate students at Princeton. And he was also a smart guy. And he was not clothed in some fashionable upper middle class, upper class Protestant tradition.
How did the other male faculties and administrators interact with you?
They didn't.
Okay.
They didn't need to. Okay. There was no reason to. And I pretty soon developed a focus. And I was sticking with my focus. And my focus was women hired in the academic department who were academically preeminent and could not be rejected on the academic grounds.
What happened to the shoebox? Did they hire any of those women?
I don't think so. The anthropologist came to the Institute for Advanced Study, and his wife was hired. But I don't think she would have been hired had there not been this talk of the need for women. She's a very competent woman. The shoebox was a symbol. And it was a symbol that there were a lot of women out there. And if they started asking about it, they might find it. But they had to ask. I was much younger then, and I wasn't there. I've lived long enough now that I'm going to be pretty outspoken. But I was not nearly as outspoken then, because it was my job to convince the dean of the faculty and the faculty committees that he met with that there were women who were qualified to be Princeton faculty. And I wasn't going to get there by hitting them over the head. I was going to have to get there some other way. And, now, if I'm on a campaign now, I may be a little more aggressive than I was when I was 30-something, in the early 30s.
Is there anything else
you want to
share?
No, I don't think so.
This has been so wonderful. Thank you so much.
No, I'm so glad to meet you.
Yeah. Really incredible story. I
think Princeton has done a very good job from what I know of co education. And Nancy, of course, has written about it, but I'm Nancy Wise Malkiel. And I will be very interested in what she says about Bill Bowen, because I consider Bill Bowen to have been absolutely integral to making a success of co-education at Princeton. And in this day of all this talk about men not treating women well. I think it's really useful to see how one man was able to do wonderful things institutionally. Well, I probably would not want to investigate all of those personal lives. So and I think that when we get all worked up about the very bad behavior of some men towards some women sexually, we need to separate that from the great accomplishments they may have in turning a major institution of American society around to be a good place for women. I'm not sure I want to make that case about Mr. Weinstein.
Right.
But I don't, obviously I am, I just think those things need to be separate.
Yeah. They're complicated stories.
Yeah. And it's the job for those of us who are interested in having a society be fair, which I'm very interested in, is to concentrate on the institutions in which we can have an impact, have an influence. Maybe not an impact, but at least a little influence. And it's our job to make those places as good as we can. And I think Princeton has done that with male leadership. So that's very impressive.
I'm personally very grateful for that.
Yeah.
I've benefited greatly.
If you have a chance to talk to Liz Cohen or Debbie Lapp, I think that would be good, because Liz is an American historian, Debbie's a lawyer, and Debbie is interested in these issues from a legal point of view. And Liz from a historical point of view, and Liz also had the experience of running the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study after the Harvard-Radcliffe agreement was signed. I ran it years ago in the 70s when it was still very much part of Radcliffe, and before Radcliffe and Harvard were relatively separate. And then when the Radcliffe-Harvard 77 agreement was signed, it waxed and waned for a while until the final Harvard-Radcliffe agreement was signed, which I think was 2001. And then Drew Faust ran it. And then, of course, Drew became president of Harvard. So it would be interesting to, and when Drew became president of Harvard, Debbie became the head of the, not Debbie, but Liz became the head of the Radcliffe Institute.
Is this the Liz Cohen who writes on American
Conservative?
Yeah.
I would think so. 20th century American historian.
Okay.
Very smart. Her husband's still at NYU. That's another case in point of the women. Hedrick is the professor of European history at NYU. She used to be at NYU. She was selected to come and be one of the early women in the history department at Harvard. He stayed at NYU. She did not negotiate a position for him when she came. And they had two daughters who were girls when she came. I don't think they were daycare eligible. They were school age. Now, who, of course, grown up. But, I mean, that's it. Debbie Lapp has remained single. She's had many friends, but she's heterosexual single.
Yeah, I mean, people's personal lives become a really important part of it.
Oh, it should.
Sure.
They should, because your personal life is what you are.
Absolutely.
And your professional life is something that you've added onto it. You know, we've all met people whom the professional life seems more important than the personal life, but that's a mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see so many professional decisions that come out of personal.
Oh, yeah.